All right, so tonight's class is entitled The Higher They Fly, The Harder They Fall, and it's supposed to be a conversation regarding something in this week's Parsha. And this week's Parsha is Parshat Vayikra. It is the first in the third book of the Torah. Yes, we've managed to make it all the way to book number three already. This is great. Things are moving along. Here's where I get the typical, oh, isn't this all about the sacrifices? Wake me up when we get back to Genesis. You know, those are good stories. The Exodus, that was exciting. You know, now we got to, if it's this animal, if it's that animal, you did this, you did that. And, oh, and the Kohen has to sprinkle the blood. And I was like, you know what? Wake me up when it's over.
Make sure it's pleasing to the smell.
Right. But the question that we're going to look at tonight is, as I love to teach you, be very precise in the wording. We unfortunately gloss over and just say, yeah, okay, that's generally what it means. But if you remember from last night, that doesn't fly. Attention to detail is what it's all about. So here's what I want to do. The Torah describes in this week's parasha various kinds of sin offerings. A person does a sin, well, not only does he have to do teshuvah, he has to repent from his actions. I'm going to try something, by the way. Okay. That you go ahead. Why are we looking at Randy? It should be on me right now. I'm the one talking. I don't get it. I moved it to speaker. Okay, everybody else is looking around. Who's playing around here? It's supposed to be this. Do you all hear me?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So I don't know why the view is on all of you. But
we can hear and see you.
We see
you. Oh.
Yeah, did you look at the picture view?
Do you see just me or you see everybody else too?
Everybody else.
I see. You could do it speaker view or you could do everybody. It's up to you.
Well, we have
everybody.
It's recording. I have it set to recording and it's supposed to be on speaker view. So I'm theoretically, it's just me, even though I'm looking at only you. That's weird. Okay, never mind. We'll go back to the gallery. Okay, there we go.
But I think we have to also set it for speaker view.
Never mind. Okay.
No, you don't.
Whatever. It doesn't matter. Okay, so you have all these different sin offerings. So besides doing teshuva, besides repenting and changing your ways, you have to actually bring an offering in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. Okay, it's obviously only for situations where it's what we call bishogeg. It's an inadvertent wrongdoing. If you purposely violate a particular sin, a particular transgression, you can't bring an offering. That is a no-no. You think about it like, wow, that sounds strange, but it's not, because the whole point of repenting, the whole point of changing your behavior is you're saying, okay, I did something wrong. Well, God says, okay, fine. But if it was an inadvertent one, so then you only need a smaller amount of forgiveness. For lack of a better term, the stain on the soul is much less than a willful, purposeful, cold-blooded sin. Then an offering is not enough. You need to do much more than that. So that's just a side point. But then in this week's parsha, the Torah gives us specific types of offenders that could bring an offering. For example, the high priest, he has a position of leadership, his responsibility and therefore the expectation of his behavior is on a much higher level than average Joe. Similarly, if the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court, which rules a certain way, inadvertently makes the wrong ruling and everybody follows their ruling, so they have to bring an offering. And then there's a third category, an individual, a regular ordinary Joe. And then there's what's known as the Nasi. In English, they translate it as the prince or the ruler, the leader. It could be somebody who has a position, a political power, a position of political power. There was such a thing in our day, in our history. So the Torah describes each one of these, if they make an inadvertent mistake, what offering they have to bring. But I want to draw your attention to how the Torah phrases it. For example, the high priest, the phrase it starts with, if the anointed Kohen will sin, bringing guilt upon the people, then here's the procedure. This is, if you want to look it up, it's chapter 4, verse 3. And it continues and describes all what has to be done. Then, same chapter, verse 13, if the entire assembly of Israel shall err, and a matter became obscure from the eyes of the congregation, which the sages teach us is where the Sanhedrin rules and everybody follows them, starts with if. However, in verse 22, same chapter, when it describes that when a ruler, the Nasi, sins, it says when a ruler sins and commits one from among all the commandments. Next is if you're talking about an individual, it says in verse 27, if an individual person from among the people of the land shall sin unintentionally, da 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 da. Three of the four examples that are given are starting with if the high priest does it, if the Sanhedrin and the great and the people follow suit, if an individual. The only exception to the rule is when it talks about the Nasi. It says when, almost as if it's a fait accompli. It is a foregone conclusion that he will sin. Not if, but when. That's highly unusual. To go ahead and to, even if it's true, but for the Torah to state it as if it's a foregone conclusion, that's depressing. Yep. When the leader screws up and he has to bring an offering, here's what he's got to do. Ouch. Not if, but when. So using this as a springboard, I'd like to discuss this concept about the Torah's view of leadership and understanding what that level of responsibility entails. So let's try to understand what this Nasi really signifies. It's a generic word that's used for a ruler, a leader, a king, a judge, an elder, a prince of the tribe, anyone who is holding some kind of political power in that a position, an official position, can be called a Nasi, not a Kohen. A Kohen is by birth. It's not a political position. It's not his role is, the Kohen's role is to be the mediator, so to say, between God and the people. It's also not, what do I call it? It's not the Sanhedrin, right? The great assembly, the judicial body. That's not what we're talking about. This person's job really is the go-between in the times, let's say, of the Mishnah, of where this was the go-between between the Jewish people and the Roman government. He would be the one to go to Rome and speak to defend the Jewish people, to go ahead and to try to enact laws that would be beneficial, similar to a lobby group today that goes in front of Congress and goes in front of the Senate and tries to lobby for what is best. The Jews had that also. It was called the Nasi. Now, it's in many different forms, even in today in the state of Israel, which is a democratically elected government, there are community councils. There's all these different political positions. Now, one of the most important messages that the Torah teaches us about that position is that it has to be within a framework of constraints. There are overarching rules that he or she must follow and stay within. For example, the primacy of Torah. You may want to have a political position that you think would be beneficial, but it may go against something in the Torah. They can't do it. The Torah's rule is the final say. For example, right? terrible example, but if what if this political position would suggest that Shabbos be moved to Monday for whatever the reason? The particular government has some things that are going on Saturday, and there's a certain demand that we participate in it. And this political nasi feels that it's in the best interest of the Jewish people to go along with it. We'll keep Shabbos, but it won't be on Saturday. It'll be on Monday. Can't do it. Cannot do it. The sovereignty of the Torah has to supersede. That's one rule. The second is similar to what we have here in the United States, and that is accountability to the people. It can't be his own agenda. It has to be in concert with, like we have here in the Declaration, right? You have to be, we the people. It has to be representative of the people's wishes. However, this is important. Contrary to what's done in our political system of where the political wins will be based on what the people want, that is not true in our system. You are representing the people, but the people don't make the final decision. It can't be just what the people's opinion is. That's not leadership. Translate the word leader, not follower. Leader, you have to lead the people. Well, the people want this. Doesn't mean it's the right thing. Doesn't mean it's the ethical thing to do. Sure, it's a good point. It's worthy of discussion, but they cannot be the final arbiter of right and wrong. It can't be left up to the people, because then it's like ties. This generation wants fat ties, next generation wants skinny ties, and then the next generation wants a bow tie, and the one after that doesn't want a tie at all. Oh, well, then who's right? Then, well, okay, do whatever you want. Well, that's not going to work. There need to be rules within which it must work. Now, if you think about it, this role of leadership, and we'll come back to why it's so important that the Torah changes it to when, we'll get to that. But if you look it up in the dictionary, everybody here knows what that is. When I do this with the teenagers, they have no clue what I'm talking about. What's a dictionary? Okay. But if you were to look up the word lead, L-E-A-D, in Webster's or Merriam, whatever it is you look at, it means sometimes taking unconventional stance, perhaps even against popular opinion. That means to lead. Not follow. Lead. The Talmud has a very interesting take. The Talmud, when it's discussing the era that will precede Mashiach's arrival, it describes what kind of society the world will be. It's not a pretty picture. In fact, it looks pretty much like ours. So that's encouraging, because that means Mashiach's not far off. But one of the expressions that's used in the Mishnah there is Pnei Hador Kipnei HaKelev. Literally translated means the face of the generation is like the face of a dog. Now, you obviously cannot take that literally, because that doesn't make any sense. But I once read and heard a beautiful explanation. How many of you own a dog? Raise your hand. Great. And you take it for a walk. Okay, Lauren, I'm picking on you tonight. You take the dog for a walk. Who's in front, you or the dog?
Usually the dog.
That is correct. And if I were a Martian coming down from outer space and I saw this vision, who would I assume is in charge of whom? Yeah.
The dog.
You would assume that the dog was leading you.
However,
for some of you, that is the case. But what you will find is that when you get to a corner, what does the dog do?
Stops and stares at me.
The dog stops, turns around, and will wait for you to make the decision which way to go, and then he'll run ahead. What a fascinating nature of a beast. It's so indicative of who's really in charge. It's not the dog. The proof of the pudding is he turns around to see what's my master going to decide to do. Turn right, turn left, go straight. Says the Talmud that in the generation preceding Mashiach, that's what leadership will look like. It'll be just like the dog. It looks like it's in front. It looks like it's leading, but all it's doing is turning around to see what do the people want. Oh my gosh, does that not describe our world right now? Oh, what do the people want? Oh, that's my policy now. Scary. But Pnei Hador, so to say, the face of the generation, the leadership is just like the face of the dog turning around to see what do the people want. That's not leadership. Leadership means you have to lead. I wasn't a huge fan, but there was, she still may be on. Maybe it's, I don't hear it anymore, but there was somebody, Dr. Laura Schlesinger. She was all syndicated radio all over the place. Very interesting lady. I didn't agree with some of what she said, but she did have a great, great quote. Loved it. She said, you always have to remember that in order to lead the orchestra, you have to turn your back on the audience. How true. How true. If you really want to know what it means, that means to lead, you have to be able to turn and not take everyone's opinion. Again, I'm not suggesting a dictatorship. That's not what I'm suggesting. But if you want leadership, that means you set the tone. You lead. How? You have to lead by example, obviously. You have to set the one. When Moshe davens to Hashem, excuse me, when Moshe asks Hashem for a succession plan, and he asks God, who is going to be the one to succeed me? He asks specifically, the Torah's terminology is, who is going to be the one to go out before them and come in before them? Yeah. Who's going to actually go out in front of the people to lead them? And who's going to come in and lead them back home? That's leadership. Not just sitting in the back and giving directions, giving orders. That's not necessarily leadership. So lead, that's the first thing. I'm going to spell it out for you very simply tonight, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to know what a leader is, then we're going to focus on L-E-A-D-E-R. The L stands for lead. Don't follow, lead. The E tells you how to do it, and you have to lead by example. You have to set the tone. You have to be a model citizen. None of this above the law garbage. You have to live by the same rules, which we're going to come back to in a minute. Okay? What kind of character do you need to be a leader? Well, the Torah, again, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but think about it. Moshe is held up on the highest standard of what it means to be a leader for the Jewish people. Well, you would have expected a leader to have great oratory skills, a great speaker, charismatic, very confident, strong-minded, probably aced his Dale Carnegie course. He knows how to influence people without them knowing it, or whatever the name of his book is. And he has experience. He's apprenticed. He's done an internship in the highest positions of government. So he learns all the ins and outs of Pullah. Yeah. Let's look at Moshe. Had a speech impediment, not the greatest speaker. Was not the strongest minded. He was, yes, confident, but you know, didn't come across as, I got this, God. Thanks for the, he's like, well, I don't know if I'm the right guy for the job. Maybe you want Aaron. I don't know. Maybe, you know. He didn't just say, you got it. You the man. And what was his experience? He didn't do an internship. He was a shepherd, for goodness sake. So why is he the perfect leader? As I mentioned the other day, we know very little about Moshe's upbringing. His youth, we only know a couple of stories. But one thing is interesting. The Torah tells us that when he came out of the palace, the famous story, he came out and he saw the Egyptian beating up the Hebrew. So he killed the Egyptian. The way the Torah phrases it, where did I put the Chumash here? Sorry. Right before he comes out, the Torah phrases it as follows. (Clears throat) The verse reads, the boy grew up. I'm sorry, I'll back up a little bit. The daughter of Pharaoh took the boy into his house. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take the boy, nurse him for me. This is to Miriam, right? Moshe's sister, that he should be taken to his mother, Yocheved, which happens. Take the boy, nurse him for me, and I will give your pay. So the woman took the boy and nursed him. Listen carefully. Vayigdal hayelet. The boy grew up, and she brought him to the daughter of Pharaoh, and he was a son to her. She called his name Moses, as she said, for I drew him from the water. The boy grew up. You heard that phrase? That's verse number 10. Verse number 11. It happened in those days, Vayigdal Moshe, and Moshe grew up and went out to his brethren and observed their burdens. In a matter of two verses, it repeats that Moshe grew up. That's a little strange. If you just want to tell me he got older, then just say, it happened in those days, Moshe went out to his brethren. Just get to the punchline. Why say twice that he grew up? Some people don't even do it once. What do you mean Moshe did it twice? I had a teacher once. It's a great story. He said to us, everybody matures at some point. Everybody matures. That's what he said. And we looked at him a little funny because we knew some people that we felt never grew up. He says, no. Everybody matures. Some people peak very early, though. So why does the Torah say that Moshe grew up and then the next pasuk, Moshe grew up? So Nachmanides asked this as a question. And he says the first time is just a physical maturity. He grew up. He got bigger. He got taller. He got stronger. Put on maybe he had a little stubble. Yeah, he grew up. But the second time, listen carefully to the verse. It doesn't just say he grew up, comma, and then tell. It says, I moved the place. It says in verse 11, it happened in those days that Moses grew up and went out to his brethren and observed their burdens. This is not a physical growing up. This is a maturity of recognizing someone is hurting. He goes outside and he sees his brethren suffering. He's beginning to feel someone else's pain. He's got it sitting pretty in the palace. His growing up the second time is an indication of his character. The mark of leadership is to show care and concern for the needs of others. This is a turning point in Moshe's life. He grew up physically. That's the first verse. The second verse says he grew up by going outside and observing the burdens of his brethren. It makes a lot of sense why being a shepherd is the perfect proving ground for leadership. What does a shepherd do all day? He does nothing more than show care and concern for the animals. It's a perfect litmus test. It's not even necessarily his own animal. It's one thing you take your dog for a walk, but if I took your dog for a walk, then it shows great care and concern for both you and your animal. It's not mine. What do I care? Going out and watching his father-in-law's flock, whether he got paid or didn't get paid, is irrelevant. But it shows care and concern. The character we're talking about here is showing attention to the care and concern. But wait, the Medrash tells us, how did Moshe come to that burning bush in the first place? Obviously, it was a grazing area. I'm sure other shepherds were out in that area. How come only Moshe saw it? So the Medrash tells us that a little sheep ran away from him. Maybe you heard this as a youngster. That the one little sheep went running. So Moshe chased it. He wanted to make sure. And he's chasing it. And he finds the little sheep drinking from a spring, a well, whatever it was. And Moshe's response was, oh, had I known you were thirsty, I would have personally brought you. And he took the sheep after he finished drinking, put it on his shoulders, and brought him back to the flock. It was at that point God said, you are the perfect person. if you can show such care and concern for the flock of others, then you should come and shepherd my flock. What a great line in the Medrash. Because that is the mark of leadership, the care and concern for the needs of others. King David also was chosen this way. He too was a shepherd in his younger years. But the Medrash tells us that King David also had this point, but he understood another aspect of leadership, and that is different needs for different people. It's not one size fits all. The Medrash tells us that King David would allow the youngest sheep to go graze first because their digestive systems were not as developed, and let them have the softest grass. Then he would let out the oldest group because, again, they're older. They had a good digestive system, but they, you know, little metal mucil can't hurt. So they knew to take care of, right? He knew to take care of that. And then he let out the middle-aged, robust ones and let them deal with whatever is left. I'm saying it jokingly, but it does show a certain characteristic about not just, well, I care about people. Well, not everybody's needs are the same. In fact, it's unlikely. It's not one size. If you want to do chesed, you want to do kindness for someone, it's not one size fits all. What works for one person may not work for someone else. Showing that attention to detail and the attention to the care and concern and realizing that there are different needs for different, that's leadership. That's what it takes. Not one thing for everyone. So L is for lead. E is by setting the example. A is for the attention for the person. And D is recognizing that it's different needs for different people. But we're not done yet. We're not done. How does one acquire this trait? Okay, some people are quote unquote born natural leaders. But most of us may have certain qualities, but how do you nurture that? How do you build that character within yourself? So I'd like to present to you a problem. The problem is that we are told in the Torah, as one of the cardinal rules of the Torah, v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. You are to love your fellow like yourself. On paper, it seems very, very logical. It even seems somewhat simple. But in practice, it really is difficult to understand, let alone put into practice. Why? Because at the end of the day, who are the three most favorite people in your life? Me, myself, and I. We are selfish creatures. That's who we are. And you may shake your head, no, and no, no, I'm not. You are. You are a selfish creature. I'm not blaming you. You're born that way. You are to be care. In fact, the Torah is predicated on that. Love your fellow like yourself. That means you love yourself. The Torah takes that as a given. So it's not terrible that you love yourself. You should. However, now we have a problem. The Torah is asking me to love you like I love myself, but I love me more. How am I supposed to do this? I'm stuck in the quandary. I love me, but I'm supposed to love you too. How? What if I really don't love you? What if I don't like you even? It's a problem. So we'll just end here. You guys figure it out. All right, fine. I'll give you a hint. I'm going to call the candles tomorrow. I'm going to call, and let's assume for the minute, Michelle's going to answer the phone. It's unlikely because she's probably busy and Sid's waiting for the phone call anyway. So one of them is going to pick up the phone. And I say, oh, so nice to speak with you. It's great. Hey, listen, when you finish getting your vaccine and you're double dosed and you're 2 weeks out and we're all double, Would you consider, Michelle, coming to us for a Shabbos meal? You're like, oh, that's great. That's wonderful. We would love the opportunity. I know we still have to keep somewhat distant. Fine, we got this. No problem. We're excited to have you. Sure enough, we pick a Shabbos. There's a knock at the door. And guess what? It's not just Michelle. She brought Sid too. Now, whoa, one second. If you recall the conversation, Michelle, you picked up the phone and you answer, right? And I'm talking to you and I say, Michelle, we'd love to have you for Shabbos dinner. You're like, great, happy to do it. And you brought Sid. I didn't offer Sid. I said, we'd like you to come. What made you think Sid was invited? Can't hear you. You're on mute.
Plural you.
How do you know it was plural? Maybe I meant it in the singular. You can't.
We're married almost 50 years, Rabbi. It's always plural.
Okay. So even those of us who are not married 50 years, it becomes plural right away. Yes, exactly. No, but the point, you're right. And that is, it's an understood, because I don't view Michelle as separate from Sid. They're a unit. Thank God they're married almost 50 years, right? They're a unit. And of course, when I said we'd like to invite you, it meant the collective you. Now, how'd you do that? How did that become a collective unit that the two of you became one? I'll tell you how. It's because you didn't change and fight and struggle and say, Sid, you're not really me. I love me more than I love you, but I'll break through this and somehow I'm going to come to love you also. That's not what happened. It's not. I don't need to know the details, but I'm sure that's not how it happened. The more likely scenario of how it happened is that Michelle sees herself in Sid. You share commonalities of goals, of values. So there's a certain level of seeing yourself in the other person, and then you're not struggling to go against your nature of loving someone else, even though you love you. What you're doing is you're expanding your definition of self. And now you see it in someone else too. Then it goes naturally. It's a natural flow. The reason why I can love you is because I see myself a little bit in there. And then I use what's natural of loving myself. I can apply it to you as well. You can go ahead and expand your definition of self more than just to your spouse, more than just to your children, more than just to your friends, and it can keep expanding. Because if you can see the good in someone else and relate to it and say, that's a trait I have or I'd like to have, you see yourself connecting with the person, then it just naturally flows. Of course, you're going to love the other person because it's a little bit of you too. Then you're not fighting it. It comes naturally. A leader is someone who can go ahead and see not just their family, but the whole nation as themselves. And therefore, what's best for the nation, I put as my priority too, because I relate to that. I quote this very often. A baby is the most selfish creature in the universe. They are. We love them. We love to cuddle and hug and kiss and go for it. But man, are they selfish. All they care about is themselves. You could be tired after a long day of work. They want your attention. And by the way, when I say baby, I don't mean 6 months. I'm talking 60-year-olds. They're also your baby. They're going to want your attention. That's the way it goes, folks. Yeah. They're selfish in a nice way, of course, right? But a leader is somebody who can view others as part and parcel of themselves, their child, their family, their friends. But how do you do it? I've convinced you it can be done. The question is, how do you do it? So I'm going to teach you a fabulous lesson. The word in Hebrew for love is ahava. Ahava. No, it's not just a skincare product. It's ahava is, I don't know how I know these things, but it's in there. Ahava means love. The root of the word ahava is related to the word in the middle, hav. Hav is Aramaic to give. Most people, if you were to ask them, Why do you give your children, your spouse, your friend, why do you give them a present? They will tell you, because I love them. That's why I give. I give because I love. Ladies and gentlemen, from this day forward, you will no longer say that as an entire sentence. You're only saying half of a sentence. Here's the other half, which is the more accurate half. I love them because I give to them. Not the other way around. I don't give because I love. I love because I give. The more you give of yourself to someone, the more you come to love them. I'll prove it to you beyond the shadow of a doubt. What is the strongest relationship between human beings? Which two human beings have the strongest bond and connection?
Mother and a child.
That is correct. And it's specifically in that order. Mother to child. Strongest relationship in the world. Why? Because the mother gave everything to the child. The mother conceived the child. Yes, the father had a token donation, but the mother mother nurtures the child for 9 months, gives birth to the child, nurses the child, raises the child. Yes, the father plays a role. However, the mother is a giver, 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 nonstop. Therefore, the love she feels for her child is unparalleled anywhere else. Does the child have the same feeling towards the parent? No, they do not. No, we do not. Because we are takers until we become parents, and then we become more givers. The equation is not, I give because I love. No, it's I love because I give. So if you want to fulfill this concept of loving someone else, give of yourself to them. The more you give, the acts of kindness of giving will create the love. The opposite is also true. It's almost like bodybuilding. When you want to work out, if I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to start lifting weights. So if I do it once a month, it's really not going to accomplish much. But if I stick to a regimen and I build up the giving muscle, then that becomes stronger. I may have shared this with you. Somebody once asked Rav Moshe Feinstein of blessed memory, great sage, passed away in the 80s, 1980s. Someone asked him if he was going to give $10 to tzedakah that day. Is it better for him to give one poor person $10 or 10 poor people $1 each? Or does it not matter? So he responded by saying, all things being equal, it's better to give 10 poor people $1. Why? He says, because number one, you're helping more people, but more importantly, or as importantly, is you have flexed your giving muscle 10 times that day instead of just once. You are exercising your giving. That means you had to reach into your pocket, pull out your wallet, give a dollar bill, put it back in your pocket, go a little further, and again, stop what you're doing, reach into your pocket. You flex your bodybuilding, except instead of it being muscles, it's your spiritual muscles. And therefore, the opposite is also true. The less you give, the more atrophy takes place. And you lose somewhat of the capacity to give, and thereby less capacity to love. The Talmud says that there comes a point of where a judge has to step down from his duties. Because he's too old. Whoa, what do you mean? In today's day and age, that's like major discrimination. You can't say that. Somebody's too old. Rashi says the explanation isn't, it's not an age factor. It's because the person, when they reaches that point of their life, they forget what it's like. It's hard to put themselves in that other person's position anymore. They're so far removed from it. Those of you who are grandparents, yeah, you have vague recollection of what it was like as your children were growing up. but you have the luxury of putting aside all that negativity and just enjoy the grandchildren for them. Why? Because now it's not your problem. You disassociate the raising of the children. That's your kid's problem. That's why you can enjoy the grandkids much more, because you're not in that position anymore. Says the Talmud, so a judge who has to weigh all the factors and try to understand that person, they can't do it when they get to a certain age. It's hard to relate to it. That's the E of leader, L-E-A-D. The D is you have to extend and expand your definition of self. That's how you come to love not just the people in your constituent group, but you can really do this for the whole nation. However, this brings us to the last letter, which is the reason for this entire conversation. And that's the letter R in leader. L was lead, E by example, A, attention to the needs of others, D, recognizing different needs for different people, E, by expanding your definition of self, you can learn to love them. But now comes R, and R stands for risk. The major risk in leadership is that we have a tendency to let it go to our heads and to think we're above the law or become arrogant and haughty. No. You see, if you're just Joe Schmo, you don't have that feeling of arrogance because you're just Joe Schmo. But if you have a position, whether it's a position in a family or a position at work where you are a manager or the boss, there's a certain tendency to feel, I don't have to worry about that. We begin to feel haughty. The Torah recognizes that, but that is human nature, and it's a real risk. So much so that it's likely that you're going to mess up. That's how strong the tendency is. You see, going back to what we started with, the Torah, when it talks about somebody inadvertently making a mistake, an individual, if. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. The Kohen may, maybe he'll make a mistake. See, again, it's not a political position where he has to win the favor of others. He's born into it. We'll talk about that in 1 second, one more piece to it. But the leader, the Nasi, it's almost probable when he messes up. Not if, but when. So what's the solution? What's something that a leader can do to keep himself in check, to keep himself focused? You know what the Torah tells us? There's a special mitzvah that applies. It's using it as a king, but I think the lesson applies in all leadership positions. There's a special mitzvah that doesn't apply to any of us and only applies to a king. The king has to not only write a Torah, has to keep a Torah with him at all times. That means a little Sefer Torah, just a little one, doesn't have to be the big one that he carries around, a small one that he keeps with him at all times. Why? Yes, so that he stays focused on the task, and he, being the most susceptible and prone to feelings of arrogance, let him keep that Torah with him at all times. A great reminder, you are not above the law. You are still God's servant, and in fact, you're a public servant. You're there to help the people, not your agenda, not what you want. It's a way of keeping that in check. Now, why doesn't the Kohen have to do that then? Why doesn't a Kohen be as susceptible? The great Meshech Chachma of Meir Simcha, who lived in Dvinsk back in the 1800s. Late 1800s, the Meshech Chachma points out that the king was especially vulnerable to being led astray by the popular sentiment. A priest or a judge in the Sanhedrin were answerable to the people, but doing what the people want, as I said before, is not always doing what God wants, right? The political leader is more exposed to the temptation than a priest or a judge. The priest spends his day doing what? What does the Kohen spend his day doing?
Praying.
What?
Maintaining the temple.
Good. he's involved with divine service his whole day, whether it's offerings, sacrifices, teaching Torah. He's involved in divine service. So the likelihood of him totally losing focus is less likely. The Nasi, who plays that political position, and he's got meetings with the governor, and he's got meetings with the vice president, and he has to put a city council in its place, and he's doing important work, divine in that sense, but he's not in Torah learning. He's not involved on day to day. He's the more mundane activities. He's much more vulnerable. But I want to end with this. And I think this is perhaps a wonderful lesson for all of us, because some of you are probably thinking, but I'm not in a position of leadership. You all are. You all are in some position of leadership. Doesn't have to be on a global scale, but you're a leader in your community. You're a leader in your household. You're a leader in your shul. You're a leader somewhere at work. You play that role. But here's what's fascinating. From the fact that the Torah switches the terminology from if the person inadvertently does something to when the ruler does it, what matters in the Torah is not that leaders never get it wrong, but that they're always open to critique, that they're open to understanding that they do make mistakes, they are fallible, and they have to answer to God and to the people. The Torah never shies away from pointing out mistakes our leaders make. I love saying it. The Torah that we have in front of us, the five books of Moses, was either written by God or an anti-Semite, because we do nothing right in the book. We do everything wrong. It's one of the two. Think about it. The Jews are in the desert. Boom. Idol worship. Moses is fuming with them. Oh, you rebellious one. And what do? They complain. They want meat. They want water. Oh, let's go back to Egypt. We get down there. No, I can't do that. How are we going to go in? Send in spies. Don't worry. It'll be gone. No, my God, they're giants there. You read the book, you're thinking, who wants this? Because the Torah is showing us everyone is human. And you must know that. We make mistakes. And we are fallible. And we need a Torah with us, constantly reminding us of what's right, what's wrong. The most important thing from a Torah perspective is that a leader sufficiently honest with himself admits his mistakes, and hence the significance of when he messes up, what he has to do to bring the word, bring the offering. I'll end with this. The Talmud makes one more insight on this word, when. In Hebrew, it's asher, aleph shin resh, asher. When asher nasi yechta, when the nasi will sin, as opposed to im, if. The word asher, what word does it sound like that you're very familiar with? Say it, Liz. I saw you mouth it.
Ashrei?
Ashrei. Ashrei. Yeah, says the great Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the great leader of the Jewish people, quoted in the Talmud. He does a play on words. And he says, the Torah is telling us, Ashrei, how fortunate it is a generation whose leader is willing to bring a sin offering for his mistakes. Asher is a play on words of Ashrei. Oh, how fortunate we would be if our leaders would admit that they made a mistake, or that they at least could make a mistake. How fortunate a generation it would be if the leader is willing to admit and bring a sin offering for a mistake. That to me is what this is all about. If you read these psukim, if you go over it and you see this one slight little textual difference of where everybody is if, and this one is asher, when, it begs the question, what is the Torah teaching us about leadership and what we need to do to capitalize on its advantages and its responsibilities and the risks that make us susceptible as leaders? Remember the word leader, L-E-A-D-E-R. You'll have no trouble being a successful leader, because that's what it's all about. Lead by example, attention to the needs of others, different needs for different people. Expand your definition of self so you can love somebody and recognize the risk that's involved. That, my friends, is a leader. Questions? No, I'm not running for office. Don't ask. No, we're good. Okay, good. Excellent. All right. I will see you, ladies and gentlemen, next week. Have a great Shabbos. Shabbat shalom. Enjoy and stay safe.
Shabbat shalom.
Pleasure.